This is KYUK Public Radio for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. I'm Evan Erickson. Representatives of the proposed Donlin Gold Mine recently offered a status update on the project to the Bethel City Council. It included a bold timeline for completing what would be one of the largest open-pit gold mines in the world. Here's a report.
If all things go well, in about 2031, we should be built.
That's Donlin Gold's general manager, Todd Dahlman, addressing the council on Tuesday.
That means in late 27, we'll start setting up for construction. 28, you'll see construction hitting hot and heavy, influx of people to do the work.
The proposed mine site sits along a tributary roughly 200 miles up the Kuskokwim River from Bethel. Donlin Gold estimates the size of the deposit at more than 1,000 metric tons. They want to extract an average of around 1 million troy ounces annually during the mine's 27-year lifespan. Following Dahlman's presentation, Bethel Mayor Rose Sugar Henderson asked what happens after the mine closes.
Are you required to put the land back the way you found it when you're done, or is it you're just going to leave it like that?
So our agreement is to restore basically everything but the open pit.
At Donlin, that pit would be a mile long, more than 2 miles wide, and nearly 2,000 feet deep. After the mine closes, the pit would fill with rainwater and seepage. The contaminated water would need to be treated in perpetuity, according to environmental law firm Earth Justice. While in operation, a 471-foot earthen dam would contain the toxic slurry of waste the mine would generate, known as tailings. Dahlman says the dam design is the most reliable being used anywhere in the world. He says the massive tailings pond that the dam would hold in place would be fully lined with an impermeable barrier.
It's lined, and so there's never any solution from the tailings that goes into the dam. So you get a very, very robust, strong, dry dam.
Dahlman says as much water as possible would be removed from the tailings pond after the mine closes. The dried-out mass of tailings would then be covered over with rock and topsoil. Opponents of the proposed mine cite long-term risks of environmental contamination, including potential leaching of arsenic and mercury into the watershed. Other criticism has centered around impacts while in operation, including the small but real potential of a catastrophic tailings dam failure. A federal judge in June recognized these concerns and ordered the federal agencies in charge of permitting to reevaluate the potential impacts of a dam failure. But state and federal courts have consistently upheld many of the permits the company needs to move the project forward. Now, Donlin Gold says it's closer than ever to beginning construction. Dahlman says the project has launched a new feasibility study needed to attract as much as $11 billion in investment. He told the Bethel City Council the project would create nearly 3,000 jobs during construction.
Once it's built, we'll be hiring right in the neighborhood. You know, I think our presentation says 800, but it's somewhere between 700 and 800 people direct hire.
Donlin has touted its record of local hires in dozens of YK Delta communities. It has what it calls a contractual preference to hire shareholders of the Alaska Native corporations it has partnered with that stand to reap the benefits. The mineral rights are owned by the regional Chilista Corporation. Nearly all of the surface rights are held by the Kuskokwim Corporation, representing 10 Middle River communities closest to the proposed mine site. Royalty payments for Chilista are estimated at $1.5 billion over the mine's life. A percentage of this revenue would be shared among Alaska Native regional and village corporations across the state. It's something that Donlin Gold has pointed to as a means of lifting up indigenous communities economically through the project. But following Dahlman's presentation to the Bethel City Council, the benefits for Bethel itself remain unclear. On Tuesday, council members raised issues like increased barge traffic, cyanide transportation, land reclamation, and others. And with the local tribe, known as ONC, leading the legal fight against the project, there's no consensus on Donlin Gold here. It's been a rough year for Alaska's 15,000 federal employees. Along with job losses and funding uncertainty, in March, President Trump signed an executive order to take away union protections from a large swath of the federal workforce. The U.S. House gave public employee unions a ray of hope last week, but as Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, Alaska's representative wasn't part of it.
The Republican-led House delivered a rare rebuke of Trump and passed a bill to restore union rights for federal employees. 20 Republicans joined Democrats to pass it. Alaska Congressman Nick Begich wasn't among them. Stephanie Rice, a federal worker from Anchorage, says she was surprised by his vote, given Alaska's high number of federal jobs.
That's 4.6% of the state's total employment. That's a huge chunk of his constituents that are directly impacted by this legislation. And so I was very disappointed to see that he didn't vote to restore our collective bargaining rights.
Rice is president of her union, National Federation of Federal Employees, Local 1945. She works for the Bureau of Land Management's National Operations Center, but says she's speaking for herself and her union, not the agency. Begich didn't respond to an interview request nor provide a statement explaining why he voted no. But the Republican who led the House debate against the bill, Representative James Comer of Kentucky, said Trump is trying to get rid of the union contracts to provide more effective personnel management and streamline the disciplinary system for federal employees.
The reality is that pre-existing union agreements the president never signed onto can subvert these efforts. They provide barriers to accountability beyond basic employee protections that exist in law.
Begich's vote and his position on organized labor more generally align with most Republicans in Congress. But it marks a departure for Alaska's congressional delegation. The AFL-CIO ranked Alaska's Dan Sullivan and Lisa Murkowski as the Republican senators who most often voted pro-union in the last Congress. And unions were big contributors to the late Congressman Don Young's political campaigns.
Congressman Young always said that the unions weren't the enemy, they were the canary in the coal mine, telling Congress when things were wrong in the facilities or the agency.
David Traver is chief steward of AFGE Local 3028, which represents employees at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Anchorage. He says Begich hasn't shown an inclination to be the champion of organized labor the way Young was. Begich last year won the endorsement of the National Right to Work Committee, a counterforce to union power. The AFL-CIO endorsed his opponent. Unions like the one at the Anchorage VA are still representing employees, but Trump's order in essence tore up their contract. Travers says that leaves workers vulnerable to unfair treatment.
I will tell you, it was an insult.
The House passed bill to restore those union contracts goes next to the Senate, but labor leaders say a likelier route for becoming law would be as part of a government spending bill next year. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Dancing and drumming are essential to Siberian Yupik culture because they have been passed down by ancestors. Josie Ungot and Janessa Nunguk are dancers and high school students in the village of Gamble on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. They wanted to learn more about how different dance and drum was back when their teacher was young.
We have Krispidu drumming for some students in a classroom in Gamble. He's been teaching this native dance class for over a year now. The younger kids are learning more dance from the older kids. When performing, the women wear modern traditional clothing made from fabrics. We call them kibah. Pitu has been a teacher for so long. He's welcoming and kind to all of us students. And he's so respectful to everybody in the community. He says dance was much more strict in the past.
Only dancers to a song was if it's that composer's daughters or wife. Those were the only ones that danced.
He says he probably wouldn't have been a drummer if he had grown up in the old days because his parents weren't drummers. Pitu tells us back then women would practice dance moves, but if a dancer made a wrong move, the older woman would throw a shoe at them.
They had a big pile of shoes, and I don't know how it was, but there were some girls dancing. But once a little wrong move, they would be thrown, a woman threw at the girl.
Long ago, the traditions were a lot stronger than today. We would be so happy to have experienced that. But then we are grateful that we didn't have to be put in that position where we get shoes thrown at us. I would be so scared I wouldn't even dance, but I wouldn't have a choice.
And I would be scared also. Bittu tells us a sad experience about missionaries coming here last century and saying what our people couldn't do. That drumming, dancing, hunting, eating walrus, and speaking our language was evil.
That was when, at one time, the drummers listened to the church. Because all since the church first came here, they said it was evil. It was instilled deep in their heart that this was evil. That drums and church don't mix.
Pitu tells us about 5 years later, when the young ministers started working, they realized it wasn't evil and came and apologized. As the years went by, the tradition slowly became less strict. For about 40 years now, everyone started dancing to any song.
We ask Pitu how the younger generation can stay connected to these traditions.
By still showing up to dances, still learning these moves. Keep learning. Know whose song's whose. The little story behind the song.
Bidu says he wants to bring back regular Sunday Atoks, a dance and drum performance. We would feel so happy to bring those Sunday Atoks back. In Gamwell, I'm Sivungurmi Janissanungok.
And I'm Biliuk Josie Ungot.
High school students Nungguk and Ungot wrote and produced that story with help from Alaska Public Media health reporter Rachel Cassandra. It's part of a grant-funded collaborative media project focused on health and wellness in rural Alaska. Find out more at alaskapublic.org. This is KYUK News. I'm Evan Erickson. Koyana for listening. Please share your news tips, comments, or suggestions. You can email us at news@kyuk.org or message us on Facebook. And stay tuned for Yoktun Ganumchit coming up.